Good afternoon, Your Honors. I am Jim Wise with the Houston law firm of Brown, Sims, Wise & White. I'm here to talk about a case which involves two firsts, as nearly as I can determine, in jurisprudence of this state. As I arrived at the courthouse this afternoon, I was thinking about first times and first time events. This is not my first appearance before the court, but I find that I'm feeling all of the emotions and the mix of emotions that I did on that first occasion. It is another first time event though for me. This is the first time I have been booked into with a twice confirmed reservation in a hotel that was closed because it was being remodeled. But happily enough, it was my first time to stay in a hotel overlooking this beautiful lake, which I enjoyed so much last night and this morning. The two firsts of this case, involve a holding by the Court of Appeals, which, to my knowledge, for the first time since the rule was laid down in Tobin versus Garcia, a Court of Appeals has stepped outside of its jurisdiction and reversed and rendered a denial of summary judgment in the trial court under circumstances which do not qualify for the exception to that rule, and in a decision which truly amounts to an advisory opinion, one that might prove to be totally unnecessary, in violation of the letter and the spirit of Tobin versus Garcia. And for the second first, the Court of Appeals has found a breach of warranty, 5111 warranty of the Business and Commerce Code, in a case where there is strict facial compliance with the requirements of a documentary letter of credit, without regard to the circumstances of the underlying contract. And I say that because the construction given to the terms by the Court of Appeals cannot possibly be reconciled with the terms of the underlying contract and the intent of the parties to that contract. If I may take the point of error concerning the commercial code first, let me spend just a moment talking about the basic relationships that we have in this case that distinguish it from others that have come before the appellate courts, especially this state. We have the eternal triangle, as some of the commentators call it, a letter of credit with the issuer, the beneficiary, and the customer. One slight difference here, which is relatively unimportant, is that respondent RTOC is not the party to the underlying contract with the beneficiary, but for our purposes, RTOC can be regarded as the customer here. And what we have is the circumstance of a drawn letter of credit, and after payment, a suit on the 111 warranty by the customer against the beneficiary. Now, that fact alone makes this somewhat unusual because, as we will see, most of the decisions of this state and the ones the parties talk about in the briefs involve the prepayment situation where presentment has been made and an injunction or injunctive relief is sought. I think that it is important to keep that distinction straight and to bear in mind that what we are dealing with in this case is not the Section 114 of the Commerce Code, which concerns the rights and duties of an issuer, but rather Section 111, which concerns the duties of a beneficiary.
Well, does 111 have applicability after payment's made?
It most certainly does, Your Honor, in all of the decisions, and a very few number, in fact, that have considered it, it does. It is a warranty which by its terms does not apply just in the prepayment or the presentment stage. On the other hand, it can also be said that a proper understanding of the relationships could result in a rule that the test of a 111 breach is a colorable claim by a beneficiary. That is, that a 111 breach of warranty suit should not take the place of an action, say, on the underlying contract, should not take the place of an action for common law fraud, both of which are an issue in this lawsuit.
Under your position, though, isn't the litigation that's going to be involved in a breach of 5111 warranty going to be extensive throughout the dealings of the parties?
Your Honor, the position we've argued for does require the court to look at the underlying transaction. That is not to say that it must resolve all the disputes in the underlying transaction. Rather, what we're saying is to be consistent with the requirements of 111 and the official comment, and to make any sense out of the relationships here, and to preserve the viability of the letter of credit, it is necessary to look beyond the four corners of the letter of credit, but only insofar as determining the elements of the breach, the warranty.
For example, in this case, instead of having a question of whether the failure to renew the letter was a breach of the agreement, suppose the dispute was over the quality of the services rendered by Sun to Uni, wouldn't you have to get into all of those dealings with the parties about what had happened and who had performed what services?
I think the case you have posed, Your Honor, makes a very strong argument for the approach taken in the First Circuit Court of Appeals, applying both Massachusetts law and Rhode Island law, in the ITEC case as well as the Emory Waterhouse case, and also the approach taken by the Fifth Circuit. And that is that in a 111 determination, the court should not be looking at all of the factual disputes, the typical contractual elements and so forth, or the common law fraud elements, but should look only to see if the beneficiary has a colorable claim. If he did, then there is no breach of the warranty. If he did not, then there is a breach. Now, even without a breach of a 111 warranty, there may, as those courts have stated, be a right to relief on general principles of contract governing the underlying contract itself. And there may indeed be common law fraud. But to preserve the viability of this instrument, the 111 breach should not be a substitute for a resolution of the underlying contract.
Why are the two connected? Why does a full suit for breach of warranty have anything to do with the integrity of the letter of credit transaction? Once payment is made, hasn't the letter of credit performed its usefulness? And now, if the parties want to fully litigate the matters between them, they're permitted to do so.
I think that's a viable resolution.
So you would get into all of, for example, if the beneficiary submitted an invoice that said for services rendered $500,000 and seeking to draw down on the letter of credit, and at some point the customer or someone else wanted to take the position that the services rendered were not worth $500,000 because of facts in the underlying transaction, couldn't they do that or not?
Well, I think the court is faced with one or the other proposition. What the Court of Appeals has done is something that is, I would submit, an unworkable rule. Either the 111 warranty applies only to the presentment and the prepayment situation, or if it is to be a viable action post-payment, the court cannot avoid looking at the underlying transaction because of the very terms of the statute itself and the official comment, which refer to, in the official comment especially, the ordinary warranties of the transferor, which, if applied to this case, would focus inquiry on whether this beneficiary had knowledge of facts impairing the validity or worth of the documents presented. Now, I would submit that there's no way that the inquiry or the determination could be made as to that knowledge of facts without looking at the circumstances, the underlying contract, the intent of the parties, and the circumstances of presentment.
Well, what I hear the respondent arguing is that you can kind of glance at them, but don't look too hard. And you're saying, well, you can look a little harder than that. But what I'm asking is there any, if you glance at them, is there anything short of staring at them right in the face?
I think that is exactly the position that has been taken in these other circuits, which recognize that the 111 warranty is not a substitute for contract resolution because the standard they've adopted is a colorable claim. That is, unless on the face of the documents presented it is clear that the, and from the circumstances, it is clear to the beneficiary that he has no colorable claim, no right to payment whatsoever, then the court should not be second guessing in a 111 suit. But rather should find that there is a no breach of the warranty and reserve the question of whether there is relief under contract or common law fraud principles. To do otherwise defeats the purpose of having the letter of credit as a convenient commercial device which cuts through that sort of dispute and conflict and facing those difficult and complex questions. To put it specifically in the terms of this case, if Sun Oil, Sun Marine, under the circumstances of the underlying contract, the performance of the parties, the obvious intent of the parties, had reason to believe that it had a colorable claim, that it's a question, perhaps, but at least a colorable claim, then there is no breach of the 111 warranty. Leaving aside whether there should be entitlement to relief on contract principles under the underlying contract, leaving aside the question of whether the elements of common law fraud can be proven, and by that means harmonizing the 111 with the 114 warranty and preserving the letter of credit as a viable commercial device. A lot of the confusion in this case arises from the fact that there has been a sort of blending of the 114 section with the 111, especially, we submit, in the discussion by the respondent. If this court should affirm the Court of Appeals, I think that the courts of this state will be some years trying to sort out the difference between these two sections of the code because they have very different purposes. There should be a different standard for review. And the 114 warranty is not at all at issue in this case. 114 is not in fact a warranty, but it defines the duty of an issuer, which is to honor a presentment. If there is facial conformity of the presented documents, unless there is notice of lack of factual conformity, in that case the issuer has an option. He may still honor, may still pay, but has an option. Now, all of the decisions that have considered 114 have said that the issuer need not look to the underlying transaction, and we quite agree that that serves the purpose we're talking about, letters of credit. that the issuer is not in a position to do that should not become embroiled in those controversies. But in this case, the 114 decisions have been cited for the proposition that under 111 there should be no looking to the underlying transaction. I would submit that the two are entirely different beasts, if you please, and have no common ground at all. In this case, the issuer did not dishonor the presentment. The customer did not seek injunctive relief, although RTOC might have done so, it decided not to. And there is no problem of the pre-presentment situation. I might add that another reversal of the purpose of 114 under the argument of respondent is that the principle of independence, that is, of not looking to the underlying transaction, is actually to protect the beneficiaries and to ensure them that they will be entitled to prompt payment if they present documents that are in compliance. It's also, of course, to protect the issuers for the reasons that I've stated. But in all of these 114 cases, the courts have either not had to reach a question of 111 breach, or they have left open that question. I would submit that this court is faced with a choice between a rather narrow approach and a more comprehensive treatment of this question. The narrow approach would be to simply take the approach that the Court of Appeals did here, which would be to focus on this specific term of services rendered and try to, under some standard, determine the meaning of those terms and to determine whether the invoice submitted, in fact, was in compliance. An approach along those lines, I think, will do nothing to further the understanding of the courts of this state of letter of credit law and how these two sections are to be harmonized and operate together. A more comprehensive approach would be to really look at 111 and 114 and the relationships of these three parties to the triangle and try to determine what sort of scheme of duties and relationships and rights best serves the interests of the letter of credit and the ordinary commercial transactions. The 114 cases seem to present a lot less problem than 111 here. The cases are in relative accord by holding that the issuer need not look to the underlying transaction, must pay if there is facial conformity, except in the extraordinary situation. The extraordinary situation does not apply here. And in any event, the five cases cited by the respondent basically are not in conflict with the scheme that we're proposing. The 111 being a test of colorable claim on the part of the beneficiary. The Paris Savings case cited by was decided a year after the Delta Brands case by the same Dallas Court of Appeals. The two cases taken together are somewhat instructive on the differences between 111 and 114 and suggest a scheme that might harmonize the intents and the purposes of those two provisions. In the Delta Brands case, there was a suit by the issuer against the beneficiary in which the issuer was actually seeking to resist payment. That case is instructive because of the examination by the Dallas Court of Appeals of the elements of a 111 breach. The court turned to the official comment to 111 pertaining to the usual warranties of a transferor and found that there are three basic warranties. First, that the documents are genuine, which is not at all an issue in our case. That the beneficiary has title to the documents, again, not applicable here. And finally, that the beneficiary had no knowledge of any fact which would affect the validity or worth of the documents. Another thing that was established in the opinion of Delta Brands is that there is really a two-part inquiry here under 111, and that is whether there is facial conformity, and secondly, whether there is factual conformity. It was not at issue in the Delta Brands case as to whether there was factual conformity. That case did not have to decide the sort of question that is before the court in this case. The following year in Paris Savings, a somewhat different alignment of the parties that was presented when the consumer was suing the issuer. And in this case, the court held that the issuer was required to pay under 114. The Paris Savings case is instructive because it adopts the standard of egregious fraud as a requirement for dishonor of a letter of credit by the issuer. Again, that court was not required to address the issue of whether in a suit between the consumer and the beneficiary, such as we have here, there might be some basis for recovery. Both of those cases, I would submit, can be harmonized with the proposed purposes that we are advancing for these two sections of the code. In GATX case decided by the San Antonio court in 1983, a distinction was drawn between prepayment and postpayment cases and between the 111 section and the 114. In that case, the San Antonio court was guided by the essential purpose of a letter of credit, which is to ensure payment to the beneficiary. The dispute there was over whether there was an underlying whether there was an unpaid debt in the underlying contract. And that court held that the issuer was not required to look at it. But by the same token, that in a 111 case, it would be proper to look at the underlying contract. I made reference earlier to the opinions in the First Circuit Court of Appeals applying both Rhode Island law and Massachusetts law, the Emory case and the ITEC case. These are perhaps the closest factual authority that is available. I see that my time is up. May I ask the court for another minute or two?
Well, you'll have 10 more minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Thomas.
May I please record Mr. Timothy Henderson will present argument for Ms. Thomas.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Henderson, and with me is Mr. Pendergraf with the Houston law firm of Pendergraf, Simon, Bunshue, and Miller. In this case, I represent the respondent, Artok Bank and Trust Limited. I will refer to the parties, Artok as Artok Bank and Trust Limited, and then for Submarine Terminals, Inc., I'll refer to it as SUN. Before I address the three crucial issues before the court today, I'd like to highlight two facts. The first fact is that when SUN finally presented documents to Southeast Bank in Miami, which facially conformed to the letter of credit, Southeast Bank paid on the letter of credit. And likewise, since this was a back-to-back, letter of credit transaction, Artok paid Southeast Bank. Artok, in substance, was essentially the issuer in this transaction, and Southeast Bank fulfilled a role similar to an advising and confirming bank. Now, the reason that this particular fact is relevant is because the strict compliance principle of letter of credit law, the independence principle of letter of credit law, has been complied with in this case. When the documents were presented that strictly conformed, the bank, the issuers, paid. The other important fact to highlight is that this contract that we're talking about here is a contract between Unioil and Sun. Artok was not a party to that contract. Artok was the only contract in which Artok was a party was effectively the letter of credit contract. The irony of that particular fact, Your Honors, is that when Artok decided on its own not to renew this letter of credit, that unwittingly triggered a provision in an underlying agreement to which it was not a party, and it accelerated rentals through July of 1994. Your Honor, the three issues, crucial issues, this court deals with are as follows. And this addresses, I believe, Justice Heck's concerns in this regard. The first issue is interpretation of the letter of credit contract itself, which this court can do as a matter of law, as this court pointed out in the Westwind Exploration case. Once this letter of credit is determined, and the second issue before the court is, was there a breach of warranties under 5.111? And the other issue before the court is the procedural issue of whether this court can affirm the Court of Appeals, which reversed the district court and rendered a decision on Artok's motion for partial summary judgment. Your Honors, the first two issues this court must deal with are interrelated. There's a two-step process here. The first step in the process is interpretation of the letter of credit. And as this court has pointed out, in, for example, the Republic Bank case, there are three separate and legally distinct contracts in the letter of credit. As a result, this is the document that needs to be interpreted as a matter of law, which this court can do. And I submit, once this contract, the four corners of the letter of credit contract are determined, then we open up the panorama, take a look at what happened, and see if there was a breach of warranties under 511. But it's a two-step process. The first step is interpretation of the letter of credit. Over here to my left is a copy of that letter of credit. That letter of credit required two things. First of all, it required an invoice covering services rendered which have not been paid when due. The second thing it required was a letter from Sun, signed by officers of Sun, that stated that Unioil had failed to pay an invoice with respect to covering services, in respect of lease payments. I submit to Your Honors that the interpretation of this letter of credit should not be a complicated task. This is the document. In fact, the transcript in Mr. Carpenter's deposition confirms this fact. What this letter of credit was supposed to do is that if Unioil had failed to pay on a monthly basis for the terminaling and storage services being provided by Sun, then Sun could draw down on the letter of credit.
And what was the purpose of having the acceleration provision in the contract?
Your Honor, Artok, as the issuer, I'm not sure can fully address that question.
Well, but you just said the purpose was to compensate lease payments that went unpaid. Why couldn't the purpose just as well have been the payment of the accelerated amount?
Your Honor, I believe the answer to that question is that if Sun, who negotiated with Artok for this letter of credit, wanted this letter of credit not to cover services rendered, which connotates past tense, and in respect to lease payments, which contemplates some sort of monthly or yearly proceeding, if it wanted to cover the building of this brand new terminal in Corpus Christi, Texas, then what it should have done is actually put into the letter of credit that this covers the construction of a brand new facility in Corpus Christi, Texas.
But that's not what this letter of credit, how that letter of credit reads. The language of this letter of credit, and I think this is borne out by the transcript of Mr. Carpenter, this letter of credit, as far as the bank was concerned, covered monthly lease payments. Once this court does interpret this letter of credit, however, the next thing the court has to determine is whether there was a breach of warranties under 5.111. Now is when we open up the panorama and take a look and see what really happened here. Sun presented an invoice and was paid on that invoice, which said that they had performed services in respect of lease payments covering services which have been rendered, not paid when due. Now the question is, when we take a look at the transaction, what really happened here? Well, what really happened here is that there was an acceleration provision in a contract to which RTOC was not a party, and these didn't represent services rendered. I submit to this court, these represented accelerated rentals through July of 1994.
What if the underlying contract had said services rendered includes accelerated rentals?
Your Honor, that's a good question, because RTOC is not a party to that underlying contract. So what is decided between the customer, in this case Uni, and the beneficiary, which is Sun, should be of no concern to the issuer. I submit to this court that, for example, you could have an underlying contract that says, if I tender you an invoice that says I've delivered 10 pigs, we'll all believe that I've delivered 10 pigs, and I can draw down on the letter of credit. But if the letter of credit says, provide me with an invoice that says you've delivered 10 pigs, then I submit that the issuer is not concerned about the definition of services rendered or the delivery of pigs in an underlying contract, to which it's not a party. What it's concerned about is, per its letter of credit, was there a delivery of 10 pigs? Or in this case, were there services rendered?
Well, but if all the letter says is services rendered, then the bank doesn't know whether that means delivery of 10 pigs or building of a refinery, unless it looks at the underlying contract.
Exactly right, Your Honor. I agree with that.
Look, why don't you look at the whole contract?
Well, Your Honor, as I stated, I believe that this is a two-step process. First, we interpret the letter of credit. What does the letter of credit mean on its four corners? What does services rendered mean, and what does in respect of lease payments mean in this contract? Now that we've defined that contract, now we can look at the entire transaction. I submit to this court that it is not fair, and issuers and banks in this state will be very concerned if all of a sudden they find out that they can be bound by terms, provisions, definitions in an underlying contract to which it is not a party. I submit that the bank is looking at this document and wants compliance and wants its warranties based on this document. But a definition in an underlying agreement, the issuer is not concerned with. Once the court has determined the letter of credit and how it should be interpreted, we look to the underlying transaction. Now, in this case, Your Honor, I would suggest that this is more than just an idle concern of RTOC Bank and Trust out of the Nassau Bahamas. This is a concern of every issuer. And the reason for that, I submit to this court, is because an issuer is going to look, if it ever pays on a letter of credit, it's going to look to its customer and expect that there's going to be some value there. That if it pays on a letter of credit because an invoice says I've delivered 10 pigs, it expects to look at its customer and see 10 pigs, because that's probably what it has a lien on. And if the customer says, well, gee whiz, we said we really didn't have to deliver pigs, then what does the issuer have? The issuer simply cannot be bound by underlying provisions in the letter in an underlying agreement, nor can those provisions be grafted into the letter of credit. Before I get into 5.111 specifically, I'd like to step aside for a moment and address a number of the cases addressed by petitioner in their brief and in their argument, specifically the Gaddix case, the Setchin case, the ITEC case. All these cases involved was a situation whereby a customer was trying to enjoin the issuer from paying on the letter of credit. And what the courts did there was wrestle with the provision in 5.114b2, which provides that you can enjoin the payment of a letter of credit if there's some fraud or some defect not apparent in the face of the documents. And what the courts have really wrestled with there is the independence principle, the strict compliance principle of letter of credit. Before they're going to enjoin the payment on a letter of credit and destroy those principles, there had better be some real fraud there. It's called now fraud in the transaction, which has been defined as a fraud which so violates the transaction that the independence principle is no longer served by having the issuer pay, and an injunction will issue. And that's what happened in those cases. I submit to this court that those cases and this case have nothing to do with each other. The reason for that is that this is not a 514B2 case of fraud. What we're dealing with here is, as Justice Doggett pointed out, a post-payment 5.111 issue, a breach of warranty issue. And these concerns that courts go through defining fraud in the transaction as some sort of terrible fraud is not applicable to the interpretation of 5.11. Those cases can be set aside. Sun's been paid, and Artok's the one that pays it, $250,000 in this particular case. The strict compliance principle in this case has been observed. Now let's take a look at the strict compliance with the warranty provisions. Now 5.111, I think it's instructive to just read that one sentence. It reads, unless otherwise agreed, the beneficiary, by transferring or presenting a documentary draft or demand for payment, warrants to all interested parties that the necessary conditions of the credit have been complied with. Necessary conditions of the credit. Now 5.111 does not read that the necessary documents required under the letter of credit have been delivered. It talks about the necessary conditions. I submit that the Dallas Court of Appeals in the Delta Brand case, and the case cited therein, as well as by Sun in this particular case, the First Arlington versus Statches case, both interpret 5.111 in their particular cases correctly. That this means something more. This warranty means something more than I presented a document that was a true and correct copy, that that's a genuine signature on it and I'm entitled to be paid. What it is, what this warranty is it's, did I present a document that was truthful? And in this particular case, I submit to this court the documents weren't truthful because services haven't been rendered as defined by this letter of credit in respect to lease payments. It was something accelerated into the future. And as a result, there was a breach of the warranty provision of 5.111. The document submitted by Sun, which read that they rendered services in respect of lease payments, those services have been rendered and not paid when due. I submit that under this particular case, that's not truthful.
Can a breach of warranty under 5.111 be used as a defense to payment?
Your Honor, I would suggest that that is not appropriate. And the reason for that is that the only defense to payment that I'm aware of is under Section 5.114B2, talking about enjoining the issuer from paying based on fraud or based on some sort of defect not apparent in the face of the document. I would suggest that the breach of warranty should be a rather simple matter, as was interpreted, for example, by John Nolan, who's written several books on letter of credit law and law review articles. He indicated and pointed out that a breach of warranty, being a warranty, dispenses with this issue of scienter. Was there fraud? Did Sun feel like they really gave some benefit here because they built a brand new refinery? It dispenses with that. The focus of 5.111 is based on this interpretation, is what they presented based on the facts, truth. This letter of credit talks about services rendered in the past. It talks about in respect of lease payments, past. Now we take a look at the underlying transaction. What is it? It's accelerated rentals through July of 1994. Your Honor, there's another reason that I would suggest that there's been a breach of warranties in this particular case, and that is to assert, Sun asserts that it was truthful in this case because it built a brand new refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas. And I submit to this court, what issuer, what bank is concerned about the capital expenditures of the beneficiary? I submit that the issuer is not concerned. In fact, I would submit that an issuer should not be concerned about the beneficiary's capital expenditures in a letter of credit such as this. All the issuer is concerned about is that particular letter of credit. And the fact that later on down the road, we get some interpretation of services rendered because the beneficiary, unbeknownst to the issuer in this case, built a brand new custom designed refinery in Corpus Christi, should not change the interpretation, the clear interpretation, of services rendered.
How can you interpret services rendered if you don't look what the underlying transaction was?
I mean, how can services rendered be defined in the abstract?
Your Honor, I would submit the court's analysis should go as follows. First of all, the court determines that services rendered relates to something in the past tense. Rendered, it's past tense. Okay? Then the next thing is the court looks at covering services in respect to lease payments. The court concludes that, okay, there's something ongoing here. Now I agree with you, Ron. Now that we've gone through just that little analysis, then we lift away the shield and we take a look underneath and see what happened here. Was something done in the past tense? Were these in respect of lease payments that haven't been paid by a union? I agree with you, Your Honor. But before we look at the underlying transaction to decide that services rendered meant a brand new refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas, I submit that at least we get to the point where we determine that from this contract that rendered is something that's in the past tense, that they've actually done something. Your Honor, to address again the issue about that the issuer is going to be concerned with what it is that their customer receives in this case. In your typical letter of credit transaction case, as I pointed out before, the issuer is going to assume that their customer has received something if they pay on a letter of credit, something of value. In this particular case, when RTOC finally, after paying on the letter of credit, tried to determine, well, what happened? Uni, didn't you pay your lease payments? And they say, well, no, we were current, but they accelerated under this clause that you didn't even know about. Now, what value was there, first of all, to Uni, the customer, and also to the issuer, who's generally and vitally concerned that the customer receives something because generally that's what they have a lien on or have some sort of security interest in. If the customer receives absolutely nothing of value based on some definition or clause in the underlying contract, I submit that an issuer is going to be awfully leery about issuing a letter of credit in the state of Texas. I'd like to turn to the third issue before the court, which is this court's procedural ability to affirm the court below, and which reversed the district court's decision and rendered on RTOC's motion for partial summary judgment. Sun apparently is urging this court to adopt a very restrictive interpretation of this court's decision in Tobin versus Garcia, and possibly even a very strained interpretation of Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure 80B3 and 81C, which provide that a court of appeals can reverse and render the decision which the court below should have rendered.
Were there competing motions for summary judgment below?
That's correct, Your Honor. RTOC filed a motion for partial summary judgment, only as to liquidated damages on the breach of contract, breach of warranty provisions. The issues of fraud and exemplary damages were not part of the motion for partial summary judgment. Sun filed a cross motion for summary judgment on all issues, claiming that RTOC was simply RTOC was not entitled to any recovery from Sun under any scenario. And what the Court of Appeals did was reverse the district court and rendered a decision based on RTOC's motion for summary judgment and then remanded the rest of the case to the district court. Apparently, however, Sun has found some support for this theory in a Court of Appeals decision out of Tyler, Rice versus English, which is cited in the brief. In the Rice versus English case, the facts of that very briefly are Rice filed a motion for partial summary judgment as to establish only that he's entitled to a seat on the county commissioners, and that he also requested damages, but that was not part of his motion for summary judgment. The Court of Appeals reversed the district court decision and remanded and basically held for Rice, who was the plaintiff. Rice, on rehearing, requested the district court, or excuse me, the appellate court, to just go ahead and render a decision. The Court of Appeals in Rice versus English decided that they could not render a decision on a motion for partial summary judgment because they felt that that was a too expansive reading of this court's decision in Tobin versus Garcia. I submit to this court, after careful reading of Rice versus English, that the grounds on which they reached that decision, that somehow they would have to sever the case, or somehow they would have to reach decisions which are not appropriately before the district court, simply should be either expressly or impliedly overruled by this court. It makes no judicial economic sense to have an appellate court, or court of appeals for that matter, or this court for that matter, to go through the entire reasoning process
and be able to reverse a decision and render a decision, but prevent the court from rendering a decision based on some strained interpretation of this court's decision in Tobin versus Garcia and its progeny, and the clear reading of Texas Rules 80B3 and 81C.
Do you agree with the rule that if Artok had not filed any motion for summary judgment, the only course open to the Court of Appeals was to remand?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Even though the issue was joined in Sun's motion?
No, I would agree with that, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that the rules, the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, say that what the court below should have done.
If there was no motion before the district court for partial summary judgment, obviously the district court could not even have granted that relief, so the appellate court could not. However, in this case, there was a motion for partial summary judgment. And on the issues raised just in that motion for partial summary judgment, Artok should be entitled to relief. For the reasons set forth in the brief and in oral argument, I would respectfully request that this court affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to begin by addressing this jurisdictional question, as long as we're presently on that, and pass on to the commercial code. The difference between this case and those cases where the issues are joined with both sides moving for summary judgment, where all of the issues of the case are determined by those motions for summary judgment, is that here Artok moved for partial summary judgment and did not take up the questions of its other alternative theories of recovery in the trial court. It has an action for breach of contract, it has an action for common law fraud, either one of which, if it prevails, could afford it the damages it's on its 111 breach theory. So what happened here is that the Court of Appeal, Texarkana, prevailed. Of Tobin versus Garcia. The case does not fit the exception to the rule, and I would submit that if this case is affirmed, the courts of appeals of this state will be confused as to what to do in the event of partial summary judgments when there is pending in the trial court alternative theories which could afford the same relief. With regard to the 111-114 dispute, I think it's interesting to note that these two parties have cited to the court 77 cases, but only six of them are cited in both briefs. Now, I don't have any statistics on whether that's an unusual occurrence in the court. Maybe it's an everyday event, but it indicates to me that these two parties are on very different paths. I must say, state the obvious once again, that Southeast Bank is not a party to this suit. The duties and obligations of an issuer, or the rights of an issuer bank, are not at issue here at all. Artok would have this court view it as an issuer bank in terms of the standard of review of the evidence, but it wants to be a customer in terms of having standing to sue. It is in the shoes of a customer here. Section 114 is inapplicable, and the jurisprudence of this state will be hopelessly confused if this court affirms on the basis that Artok, or that the review applied to the alleged breach by Sun should be the same as a Section 114 review. To expound just a bit on the proposed application of 111. if 111 is to be treated as a warranty applying to post-payment cases at all, a question raised by Mr. Justice Doggett, if it is, however, to be applied to post-payment, I would submit that it makes sense to adopt the criteria of a colorable claim on the part of the beneficiary. In a typical suit of that kind, we would have the parties aligned as they are here. We would have the same theories of recovery asserted by RTOC or the customer as we have here. That is, it would be a breach 111 cause of action, a cause of action on breach of contract, perhaps a cause of action on fraud. The proof would be on the beneficiary to show a colorable claim. The standard of review would be to look at all the circumstances and the facts. If the beneficiary cannot show a colorable claim, then the customer should be entitled to summary judgment. We need not go any further. He should be entitled to relief, should be entitled to damages. If a colorable claim is shown, however, the burden of proof should shift to the customer to come forward with the usual proof on breach of contract and the underlying contract and the elements of fraud. I would submit that any other standard of application of these two sections, or of the 111 breach, makes no sense, is unworkable, and will result in hopeless confusion.
Counsel, before your time's up, would you address the your opposing counsel's argument, letter of credit for payment for services rendered in the past, and the release payments that have already been paid? Would you address that argument?
Your Honor, the essence of this contract on its very face was that Sun was to design and construct a terminal for the exclusive use. This was not a situation where an owner of a lease or a lessor was merely renting or leasing property to an ordinary lessee. What we really had here, all that was called a lease, is in reality a deferred payment purchase, where the payments for the services were amortized over a 15-year period. There is no other justification for an acceleration clause. There's no other justification for having a letter of credit triggered or to draw on a letter of credit triggered by non-renewal of a letter of credit. What RTOC is arguing for is a construction of the underlying contracts that cannot possibly be reconciled with the language of paragraph 6.04 or the obvious intent of the parties. The services rendered by Sun were really of two kinds. One was the design and construction of the facility. The other one had to do with the month-to-month operating. Uni was current on one and not on the other. The section 6.04 required that a draw be authorized under the letter of credit in the event of its non-renewal. So the letter of credit was the only security device Sun had for the long-term debt. Once again, we would submit that the Court of Appeals should have sent this case back if it found that Sun was not entitled to summary judgment. We think the Court erred on that score for the reasons that I've just stated, primarily the services rendered clearly under the underlying contract. The intent of the parties included the design and construction of the facility. I thank the Court for its attention.
That concludes the arguments.